Hi everyone, I'm Laura Kaluger, Senior Editor with Commercial Property Executive, and you're listening to and watching a special edition of our CPE podcasts. One of the most complex challenges in the US for city planners, urbanists, architects, and designers is bringing 20th century suburbs to the present. There are lots of areas across the country with underperforming properties that are in desperate need of redevelopment. Two architects and professors, June Williamson and Ellen Dunham Jones, have been documenting how American suburbs are being redeveloped, re-inhabited, or re-greened. June and Ellen are joining me for an in-depth discussion on how urban areas across the country are changing to address today's challenges. June, Ellen, thank you for accepting my invitation. I'm really glad I have the chance to talk to you.
Thank
Pleasure
you.
Pleasure to be.
You are both the co-authors of Case Studies in Retrofitting Suburbia, Urban Design Strategies for Urgent Challenges, right? Which is the second book in a series on suburban redevelopment. Who did you have in mind when you wrote this book? Who would benefit most from reading it and keeping it close on their desk?
I'll start. We chose the case study format precisely because it's really accessible to students on the one hand and mayors on the other, and all the professionals who shape our environment. We tried to keep the language accessible so that we were thinking of everybody.
It's really easy to read. I had the chance to go through the first few pages. I'm still reading it. It's really interesting. I had a hard time putting it on my night desk when I read it. So yeah, it's really interesting to read, even if you're not into architecture or into anything that has to do with urban planning. It's just interesting to know how cities and how urban and suburban places have changed and how much they've changed, right?
We think so.
Are there any fundamental principles that have guided your work for this book series? Because from your website, I know you wanted to showcase the design strategies that are being used to address contemporary challenges like public health, climate change, equity, affordability. So how did you choose the projects that you featured in the latest book? Because I know you've been tracking changes in suburban areas since the early 1990s. So you must have a huge database to choose from. And I think it's hard to select.
You know, in the first book that we did a dozen years ago, we were really looking at the development types that came out of the mass suburbanization kind of transformation that happened in Northern America, the kind of explosion of suburban areas, shopping malls, office parks, and so on, where the nation's transformed from a center city where business occurred and some people living in the periphery, where really everything was happening everywhere, but housed in different types of buildings, very car dependent. For the second book, we really wanted to highlight six key urgent challenges that are experienced globally and in center cities as well, but we wanted to kind of drill into the specific opportunities that addressing some of those challenges posed in suburban areas, and to really raise the bar in the second and third generation of suburban retrofits. So foremost, disrupt automobile dependence. So basically none of the case studies got into the new book unless they were doing something on that front. And really, you know, part of this isn't about rejecting cars altogether, but reducing the need to use them for everything. So really, you know, giving people more options and choice that would be more efficient, fewer emissions expelled by the vehicles, and so on. And then second, improve public health. And there's been a lot of research about this, about how suburbanization and the sedentary lifestyles associated with that have actually had adverse health impacts on the population, particularly with respect to kind of chronic diseases, but also accidents, literally, you know, being hit by cars. And then supporting an aging population, and that's a kind of big demographic shift that's really been experienced in the suburbs, and it cuts across these persistent stereotypes that, you know, suburbanites are kind of nuclear families with children. And, you know, that's a shrinking segment of the populations in Northern America over time. So how do we adapt and meet the needs of this segment of the population that's living longer and therefore represents a larger proportion of the population, and particularly in suburbs? And then leveraging social capital for equity, which is also responding against cutting against stereotypes that there's more poverty in suburbs, there are more immigrants in suburbs, there's it's a cross section of the American population. So we can't really speak of the suburbs as kind of the secondary population. It really is Northern America. So how can these retrofits be leveraged to redress some past wrongs and also provide more opportunities in the future? Competing for jobs, retooling mm-hmm. some of these obsolete types for competitiveness, and then, of course, adding water and energy resilience. So really thinking about all this new knowledge that's coming from the built environment professions and has often been framed as upgrading infrastructure in center cities or building brand new infrastructure in the periphery, but how can that be part of the retrofitting equation, particularly mm-hmm. when we're talking about retrofitting fairly large parcels of land, a big office park, a big shopping mall. These are it's a lot of acreage involved potentially. So instead of just thinking about new things on the periphery, we really wanted to draw the conversation in much more robustly into how we remake the places that are already built or already populated, but mm-hmm. aren't functioning or working as well as they.
Okay, let's dive deeper into what is stimulating change in how and where people live. Because we've been through a global health crisis, it has definitely left a huge mark on the way people use the spaces around them. We're really more thirsty for green spaces, we crave for connection, and we also seem to have become more conscious of everyday life. What does all of this mean for you as architects? How are people's new needs impacting your views?
Suburban development has traditionally, in Northern America, I mean, it's absolutely valued the private realm and pretty much neglected the public realm. So most suburbanites, absolutely, they love their homes, and we've sort of pulled what used to be public, going to the theater. Well, now people have a home theater and, you know, right, stay home and watch TV. Everything is centered on the private space. And, you know, if you think of the roads in between in most suburbia, you get really traffic clogged, super wide arterial roads. And it's a full lined with parking lots and strip malls. It's not a high performing ecologically, economically, any of the above. So the public realm has pretty much been ignored. Now, whether it's through improving the streets and really making streets, getting more trees lining the streets, wider sidewalks, getting in bike lanes, getting in transit lanes, whether it's replacing parking lots with parks and depaving, and we see a lot of that, and places for people to actually gather together as a community, or even just reconfiguring new housing types that are more communal, where with communal courtyards, all of the above, retrofits are providing us with a much healthier, safer, and more accessible, more, in some cases, more affordable public realm for everyone. The more time people are spending online, the more they crave they don't have to be talking to other people, but they crave being in a, feeling part of a community. I mean, just the town green, and it might just be AstroTurf, but having some kind of town green, a place that is actively programmed with yoga classes in the mornings and farmers markets on the weekends and movie nights. We see that in many, many, many of the retrofits, especially the redevelopments. So
Would you like to add anything else, June?
I think part of this is not only people spending more time online, but also wanting to reduce the amount of time they spend commuting or driving in cars. Mm-hmm. So I think that period of COVID and the pandemic really caused people to reflect and coming out of it wanting to reset and reprioritize their lives. And so that I think has triggered or intensified pre-existing trends. So Ellen and I certainly have been tracking this for a while, and these sorts of desires were latent everywhere, mm-hmm. I think, and were being expressed in certain developments. And when we talk to the development community in the suburbs, often there's a reluctance to take risks and try different things. So you're looking for comparables and to kind of do what's been done before. And so in our first book, and it, you know, we were tracking examples that in some cases bucked those trends. And, you know, they were often a champion for the project, really trying to make it happen. And I think now the appetite has intensified on the one hand, and then the opportunities with respect to more closures of retail space. And it's not just the pandemic. Again, it was overbuilding, oversupply. It was kind of built into the economic model of building these things. And now we're seeing it happen in the office sector as well. So there is opportunity and desire kind of matching up, and a recognition that people are lonely. They've been, they haven't felt like they've had a choice, maybe. Right. And now it's more and more apparent that changes can be made, that it's not just a given that things have to stay the way they have been in the past, or that you either are in the city and have all kinds of amenities available to you, or you move to the suburbs and therefore everything has to change. It's like you can have both.
Right. And there are things that people are not willing to give up, such as, I don't know, they've got accustomed to remote and hybrid work models. And that is having a huge impact on suburban redevelopment, because people don't use their cars as much. They're more comfortable working from a co-working hub, for example, which is closer to their home. So how are suburban neighborhoods changing as a result of this? And what is happening to those previously bustling urban core areas where people used to go every day to work before the pandemic?
Well, I think, you know, as June pointed out, I mean, the pandemic has accelerated both the supply of dead retail space, vacant office buildings, as well as the demand for more mixed use live work town centers, primarily in the suburbs. It's also, unfortunately, I think the pandemic has accelerated suburban sprawl. So we're still seeing a lot more development just going further out, chewing up the countryside and building. Sometimes they're building mixed use walkable places, but more often it's just the same separated uses. Everything has to be get accessed by car. So I think no one loves to commute, but I do believe that we're seeing demographically, we are now a country where more than 50% of households are one or two persons. And the one single person households, I think, is now up to 30%, which that's where the loneliness epidemic that June referenced also really comes in. And you know, it's nobody wants to commute, but it is also very lonely to just live in completely by yourself and feeling really quite disconnected in that the old model, traditional model of suburbia. So I know we're seeing in Atlanta, where I live, we are seeing some vacant office buildings converted to housing, and that is really going to help our downtown. But they're not enough of those office buildings are designed so that they're easy to convert.
It's difficult to convert them to housing, to residential use. Right.
It's mm-hmm. a limited window of which ones can do that. But we're seeing that a lot of those people who are living in the quiet, single-use, monolithic, just houses, nothing else, suburbs, are starting to miss that hustle and bustle of downtown. And they're they are beginning to come back a bit. So,
and maybe, you know, I'm located in New York City. We experienced the initial impacts of the pandemic quite acutely, and it was it was traumatizing. And I've certainly observed a return to the city, nightlife, and other things. But if we're looking at the white collar professionals, high income, that really has changed. I think people in all sorts of other job categories are out there hustling, working. And I think sometimes we miss the bigger picture. I think economically of all the different types of jobs that people have. And there's only some sectors that are suitable and amenable to working at home. And when we think about retrofits too, you know, retail spaces are places of work, not just of leisure. Residential neighborhoods are increasingly places of work in terms of people who come in to do yard work or house cleaners or childcare. So there's really a whole, you know, spectrum of work and people who have to move all across the metropolitan areas. So I think if we scale back a little bit and think about retrofitting in a more holistic metropolitan scale way, I think there's all kinds of opportunities to improve the kind of daily lives of people who are in all kinds of economic sectors, and to make their lives more efficient and more kind of connected. One piece I wanted to highlight, and Ellen began to allude to it, with respect to the loneliness epidemic, and this, some of these one-person households are older Americans. They've sort of, you know, passed their childbearing years, or they're not having children. Is the need for third spaces? And already in the new book, we talk about this at length, and we highlight a number of case studies, examples of taking strip malls and kind of refreshing them or giving them makeovers so that they aren't places where you just run in and do your errands as quickly as possible, but you might linger and have coffee and meet with friends. So they're kind of designed that way in suburbs, and also remaking some of the shopping malls so that they're oriented to some of the dominant ethno group, sort of immigrant groups that have moved into to areas. So this is where they find out about cultural practices at home, or even have political kinds of meetings or certain kinds of cultural celebrations. So the evolution of some of these places to meet those cultural and social needs is really pretty significant, and something that we're quite interested in tracking and telling the stories about.
And when these dormant suburban areas get a new life, they have the chance to become like a second downtown. And this is a trend I've seen in many cities across the country. It translates to less traffic to and from urban core areas and more development, basically, in suburban areas. And I know you have a very good case study in your latest book. I'm referring to the 300-acre corporate R&D campus in Austin that's undergoing a massive transformation. Can you please expand on this and the impact of this project?
Sure. Austin is a particularly hot market. It's the only city we included three projects from, because they are raising the bar in a number of ways. That particular project, Domain, took a car-oriented, former low-rise, sprawling IBM campus and made it walkable and mixed use by inserting narrow, slower streets that are lined with retail at grade and housing or office above. And so they kept still some of the old office buildings and old parking garages that they had. So they re-inhabited some of the manufacturing buildings with creative office and a very popular restaurant row. They re-greened some of their parking lots, but they mostly just added all this new, much more walkable, mixed-use development. And they even got some new transit opened near the site. The project now has attracted very well-known tech companies that sort of replacing IBM to what are now sort of, you know, 15 story and plus towers. So it's a very successful project, and it touts itself as Austin's second downtown. It's about 12 miles mm-hmm. from the downtown. But there are Austinites who deride it as it's like living at a mall. Much of its retail are kind of the same shops. It's open air, but they are some of the same shops you would find at a mall. And yet the restaurants are all very local. So it's a really interesting mix. But it manages to appeal to both sort of younger employees who want to live right in that live work, be in the middle of a very social, more urban place, but can't afford downtown. Or if they can afford downtown, they're coming by transit. And at the same time, those employees who are living further out in the suburbs now don't have to commute all the way in to downtown. It's one example. We've got at least 150 similar kinds of projects that have been proposed, but Domain is one of those that is the furthest along, because these office park sites tend to be very large. Mm-hmm. I mean, up to 1,000 acres. They are all trying to put in some walkability. I mean, we're seeing that's absolutely pre-pandemic, and it just accelerated post-pandemic.
Maybe I could just add on to that a little bit. What we're seeing, I think, and I alluded to this earlier, is a shift to a kind of incremental metropolitanism or a polycentric kind of view. And that's certainly what we promote and advocate, is that it's not a zero-sum game, that things are either the center city or the suburbs. We're beginning to see the suburbs take on many of the characteristics that maybe have traditionally been associated with choosing to live in the city. And in thriving kinds of economies like Austin, there's room for both. The pressure on the downtown is immense, the cost of housing and development and so on. So there is an opportunity for spreading around, and we certainly think that that should happen. So we're seeing the maturation and evolution in some sense of those former edge cities paired with a kind of retooling of the downtowns. And we think this is very positive. I think the story or the narrative is different in other metropolitan areas in Northern America that might be experienced economic and population shrinkage. And that is part of our message too, that it's not the same result everywhere. So maybe this is an opportunity to talk about our sort of three big strategies that when we sort of look more broadly over all of the case studies that we've assembled and looking at them geographically, in some sense, we see three main strategies. So one is redevelopment, and that often includes intensifying the density, adding new uses, mm-hmm. making it mixed use and more of a kind of a node in a place. And then re-inhabitation, which might involve changing the use. So you still have the same building, the same parking lots, and so on. Maybe you spruce them up, you change them, but it's basically a reuse. And then the third is regrading. So that can be a de-densification, a demolition, returning to park and open space. And that often can have benefits to the broader environment, the watershed, animal habitat, because some shopping malls, especially in the 1950s and 60s, they were built on filled wetlands. And with the impacts of climate change, we're seeing flooding and other kinds of negative impacts that go beyond the property itself to the surrounding areas. So basically, by removing some of that development, it could stench the economic decline that could spread to neighboring properties by having a vacant white elephant in the midst, and also do this kind of environmental repair. So, you know, from our viewpoint, it's not a one size fits all, but different kinds of solutions will and are emerging.
So considering you have all this background, and you know so many things about how suburbia has evolved, how will suburban America look like 10 years from now? How do you imagine it?
Well, I think, you know, June already talked about the incremental metropolitanism that we really do see. It's not that downtown is going away, but it is that a more multinodal, and what that allows is also now transit becomes much more feasible. And with autonomous shuttle buses and things that are being used in some of these retrofits, that reduces the cost of operating transit to lower density areas. I mean, so there's the potential in a big way to, I think, see varieties of places. And again, as June mentioned, I mean, the market makes an enormous difference. Hot markets, slow markets, stagnant, shrinking market. It makes a really big difference in what you're going, what is feasible. But I think getting transit to be more affordable with autonomous vehicles and get it redeveloping these nodes in ways that the original suburbs were just never designed for. It's such an old model, this idea that, oh, the central business district is tall towers and the rings of lower and lower density go out. That model was never fully true, and it's going to continue to not be true.
And there still are lots of areas of suburban areas that are in desperate need of redevelopment. What is hampering more retrofits in suburban America? Is it a matter of zoning, political will, or financial power, a leadership void in terms of vision, or a mix of all of these?
It's a bit of all of it, and it really does depend on the local conditions and sort of what's happening right where there's opportunity. So we certainly advocate a kind of nimbleness and creativity, patience as well. And the case studies we put forward, we select them because we hope that they provide lessons and are replicable elsewhere. So we're less interested in showcasing a case study that is so unique and one-off that it doesn't have lessons to be learned elsewhere. So having examples as urban designers and architects, I think, is really important because you can bring those stories to folks whose minds need to be changed and inspire them and give them the vision of what might be possible, because people's imaginations can be limited. They just want to return to how things used to be in the past or something like that. So I think that's really important. But context really does matter. I think one thing that we've seen some momentum in is changing zoning. You know, it should be a flexible tool to respond to what needs are and to kind of direct development in a more focused and strategic way, but it hasn't been used that way. It's been kind of frozen in stone in many jurisdictions. So the kind of changes in what's called R1 zoning precludes having more than one dwelling unit on a property really doesn't fit the needs of the homeowners that it's meant to protect. So if you have a preponderance of owners sort of saying this doesn't suit my needs, I would like to be able to use my property in more flexible ways, and there's people who need the housing, whether they're related to me or not, and really this desperate need for more housing choices to meet the more diverse households is really a key driver, I think, of change. And that pressure is going to, I think, unlock more opportunities across the suburbs. Even if people buy into the stereotypes more broadly and they think suburbs elsewhere are all homogenous, they know where they live is not. And that, I think, is really gonna fuel some of these changes at the very local level where some of these decisions get made in terms of approving projects and so on. So I think we're hopeful, even though there are many, many barriers as you queued up, from zoning, politics, definitely, where these things have been kind of politicized in ways that are really quite baffling at the national kind of conversation in the US, certainly.
I want to add also, one of the things that actually I was especially surprised by. I grew up in New Jersey, the most suburban state in the country.
Right.
And I thought as we would start looking into these, we were going to, there's so many dead, dying strip malls in New Jersey. I thought, oh, it's going to be a hotbed of retrofitting. And in fact, what we found is that the size of a local planning department and their capacity to negotiate the very complex public-private partnerships makes an enormous difference in how, what kind and how much retrofitting we really see. So it's literally the size of governance. New Jersey is made up of very small townships and boroughs that are part of a county. So you have very fragmented government. And I was absolutely astonished that we really couldn't find any projects in New Jersey. Meanwhile, Arlington County, Montgomery County, outside of Washington, D.C., are very large counties. They have some of the largest planning departments. Just they have the staff, they have the capacity. And mm-hmm. that makes it easier for the developers to be able to talk to them and, you know, go through the approvals process and the fine and the very complex kind of every single one of these decisions is custom negotiated in a way mm-hmm. that when you're just doing new development, we've been doing that for 80 years in the suburbs. It's a standard way. This is custom. And that has been where we've seen an enormous difference. Ultimately, New Jersey is getting quite a lot of retrofits now, led by the transit agencies, because they had the staff and capacity to begin to do more.
So we're almost at the end of our conversation, and I don't want us to end it before asking you where we can find the book and if you have other plans. Is a third book coming?
Well, I'll just say the book can be found here. The book can be found at all online booksellers, Amazon, or through the publisher Wiley, and hopefully in your library, local library. You could request that the library order a copy. And then there's also our first book, Case Studies in Retrofitting Suburbia. But they're sort of they're two distinct books. There we go. That's the first book, which is available. And they're both also available as ebooks. So that's an option also. And as for a third book, well, not yet. Stay tuned.
Not yet. It's too soon to talk about the third book, right? It's too much work. Yeah.
It is a lot of work, but what's fascinating to me is actually, I mean, there are more and more scholars kind of in this area. I think June and I both want to see other, you know, more people pick this up and start doing this. So I haven't told June, but June, my PhD students want to start adding some new case studies to our website.
Yes, we have a website, retrofittingsuburbia.com. So people can
yes,
also
see. I checked it out.
I forgot. Ellen, do you remember? It's .org
it's
or
retrofittingsuburbia.com.
.com.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you both very much. It's been really, really nice talking to you and learning, basically. I learned from you. I feel like I've learned from you. Thank you all for listening and watching. If you like this episode, please rate and review it on the podcast platform you're using. Till next time.